Support for Tested comes from Duke Health, reminding listeners that COVID-19 vaccines are safe, effective, and can protect individuals and others from the virus. Together, communities can end this pandemic. Find sites for a free vaccine at DukeHealth.org.
This episode of Tested contains brief descriptions of violence, including sexual assault and murder.
I have never been a angry person. For me, one of the things that when I first got convicted and went to prison, it was an older gentleman who had been in almost 20 years, see me walking around the yard, and he called me and he said he wanted to tell me something. And he said, you know, if you want to live, he said, don't be angry, because anger eats you up from the inside out. And he asked me, do I want to live? And I said, yes, because I want to prove my innocence.
Daryl Hunt spent nearly 20 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. In 1984, Hunt was wrongfully accused, then wrongfully convicted, then wrongfully imprisoned for the rape and murder of Deborah Sykes in Winston-Salem. The investigation was flawed, witness testimony left loose ends, and there was no physical evidence that tied Hunt to the crime. Deborah Sykes was white, Daryl Hunt was black. By the time Hunt was exonerated in 2004, the people who wrote about his case and read about it in papers all over the country were stunned at Hunt's willingness to forgive the people in a system that had failed him so miserably.
I learned that in order for me to ask God to help me or to forgive me, I got to first be willing to forgive others for what they've done to me. I don't have the right to go to God and ask God to help me or forgive me.
He received financial compensation from the state and a settlement from Winston-Salem. He used the money to start a foundation to help formerly incarcerated people re-enter the outside world. But while many had heard about his grace and humility, few knew that Hunt was quietly suffering.
He was struggling with what I think is the cumulative trauma of being wrongly incarcerated and the trauma of these repeated defeats and being let down by a system in a country that's supposed to be there to protect our rights and to make sure that an innocent person is not in prison for something that they didn't do. But it doesn't always work, and it didn't work for him. And I think he suffered from, in a sense, the cultural burden of being a black man in a world where there is systemic racism and bearing that burden. So he carried that with him, and, you know, it looked like he was doing well, and he wasn't.
This is Tested from WUNC, a look at how we're responding to the day's challenges in North Carolina and the South. I'm Will Michaels. Phoebe Zerwick has written a book about Daryl Hunt's story called Beyond Innocence. It starts when she was fresh out of journalism school at Columbia University and moved south.
So I started at the Winston-Salem Journal in 1987. I was a bureau reporter, and maybe my first or second weekend in North Carolina, and I'd come here from Manhattan, so big culture change. A couple of other reporters took me on a tour of Winston-Salem, which meant taking me on a tour of crime scenes and then ending up at a barbecue joint for barbecue and sweet tea. And we started off at the scene of the murder of Deborah Sykes, who had been a copy editor at the afternoon newspaper, and she had been murdered 3 years earlier. She was a young woman, you know, kind of like all of us, we're a young journalist, and she'd been raped and stabbed to death two blocks from the back door to the newsroom. And a young black man, a teenager really, named Daryl Hunt, was very quickly picked up and arrested, and by then he'd been convicted in her murder. So that was my introduction to this case as a story that was a defining story for the community I was living in. He was in some of the worst prisons in the state beginning in 1985. So they used to send all, it wasn't a juvenile place, it was for young male adults, so ages 18 to I think 21 or 22. They would send them all to this place called Polk Prison. They were kind of all crammed into this space that then they would then lock up. The guards wouldn't go into the dorms because it was too dangerous, and they were crowded in triple level bunks. So imagine the energy and the kinds of things that could happen when you crowd that many men into triple level bunks. And then he was moved to a place called Blanche, which was in Caswell County, which was and still is to some extent really home to people who are members of the Ku Klux Klan, and that's been dating back generations. And he was in a prison that was known as Little Alcatraz. So they put the most violent people there because it was such a secure place. So these were the kinds of places where this teenager and then very young man who was innocent and knew he was innocent, these were the kinds of places he was sent. And then in 1986, the police in Winston-Salem, they had a whole long list of unsolved murder cases that they were trying to solve. And he got railroaded in a second murder case that happened in 1983. So there he was, 20 years old, serving time for something he didn't do, being charged with a second murder, which he also didn't do.
Hunt's defense team appealed, and the courts ruled there were grounds for retrials in both cases.
So Daryl Hunt is in the middle of that trial in this other murder, and the prosecutor offers him a plea bargain, which is that if he would admit guilt to both murders, he could go free. They would consider the 6 years he'd served in prison by then as time served. First of all, that is a remarkable offer for a prosecutor to make. Most of our felonies are handled by plea bargains, but no prosecutor who thought he had a good case would offer somebody a plea deal like that in a murder and rape of a woman, an innocent woman in a city's downtown. In fact, if you believe in the death penalty is designed for that kind of crime, a crime in which somebody suffered tremendously during the murder. So that was one extraordinary point. The other thing, even more extraordinary, is that Daryl Hunt turned down the offer. Basically, he refused to tell a lie. He refused to admit to something that he didn't do. And he ended up getting acquitted in that earlier murder, but he was convicted a second time in the murder of Deborah Sykes, and he went back to prison.
At this point, I think a lot of people would be saying, how does this happen? How does he get charged with two murders he didn't commit and get convicted of one of them twice?
I mean, the first thing that was a problem for Daryl Hunt was that he was a black teenager, poor, almost homeless at that point in his life, who was accused of raping and killing a white woman. And that crime has, or even the idea of that crime, has been part of the myth that we created in this country dating back to slavery, that black men are somehow or other to be feared, that they are vicious brutes who are going to harm white women. So that was part of the culture during slavery. It's part of that mythology was used to justify Jim Crow laws, and that fear, false fear, but that fear was part of the pressure that led to Daryl Hunt's arrest. And really, once he was arrested, his conviction was all but inevitable. Adding on top of that, the many, many flaws in our justice system that you see in, we now have 3,000 proven cases of wrongful conviction in this country. And the things that went wrong in Daryl's case are common in all of these cases. And then add on top of that, that there was an intentional cover-up in Daryl Hunt's case.
By the early 90s, investigators across the country had started using DNA evidence in criminal cases. It took until 1994, nearly 10 years into Hunt's imprisonment, before a judge agreed to order DNA testing in his case. A few months later, the results were back.
And his DNA did not match the semen sample recovered from Deborah Sykes' body, and neither did any of these other people who the police were always saying maybe were his accomplices.
As Zerwick writes in her book, Hunt could barely hear his attorney Mark Rabel giving him the news over the static on the phone, but the sound of Rabel's joyful voice was enough. Hunt wrote in his journal that his face was wet with tears. He gave away his toiletries to other prisoners. But what should have been another ticket out of prison became just another example of the length to which the system would go to keep Hunt behind bars. A judge wrote that while the state's case, quote, is somewhat weakened by the DNA evidence, its case overall is not fatally flawed. He denied Hunt's motion to dismiss and his motion for a new trial. Here's Mark Rabel on WUNC in 2007.
I was angry from the get-go. I know I put my fist through one door in 1986, and I slammed my fist on the courthouse door in 1994 when the judge ruled against us on the DNA, and I think I broke a bone there. Mm. And, yeah, I mean, whereas Daryl was able to not let anger control him, I guess since I was free, I was free to let people see my anger because I was on the outside. Yeah, I let the anger out. Daryl couldn't show his emotions. He couldn't let the guards know how he felt.
A film crew started following Hunt's case around this time. Filmmakers Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg were gathering footage for what would become the documentary, The Trials of Daryl Hunt. You should watch it because it's remarkable. They followed Hunt's next appeal to the North Carolina Supreme Court, again arguing that the DNA evidence should rule him out or at least grant him a new trial. And they were in the room when Mark Rabel and activist Larry Little called Hunt with that ruling.
Daryl?
Yes.
This is Mark. Hey, have you talked to Ben yet?
No.
Well, we lost 4-3. It was Justice Myers wrote the opinion. And we had Exum and Webb and Fry on the descent. I'm really sorry, Daryl. I think Ben is going to be calling you at 10:30, okay?
Well, I was thinking we would have some good news, but we don't. And 4-3, you know, that close. Ben, is, when he talked to you, he tell you about we are going to be going immediately to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Thank you, everybody, for me, and
Daryl,
yeah, it was a devastating moment.
Again, former Winston-Salem Journal reporter Phoebe Zerwick.
It speaks to, well, it speaks to two things, I think. It speaks to the fact that our appellate system is set up for finality, and that it's set up for procedural errors. So you can't go to court and say, I'm innocent, my jury got it wrong, and I want a new hearing because I am factually innocent. You can go to court and get a new trial if you can prove that some procedure was mishandled in the court proceedings, or you can go to court with new evidence, but the bar for getting a hearing on this new evidence is so very high that in Darryl's case, no judge thought that he met that bar. They adopted what the prosecution argued, which was, well, he could have killed her, but not raped her. Somebody else might have raped her. Somebody else who we've never thought about could have been there with her and raped her. Or they said, it even got to the point where there were arguments made, well, and this is a little crude, but he could have killed her and raped her, but failed to ejaculate. So it became nonsensical. And the experience for Daryl Hunt of being denied justice for 10 full years after he had what should have been proof was absolutely devastating.
For me, every day I would try to find something positive. If someone did not speak to me in a month, and then one day he just walks by and speaks to me, that's a positive day for me. So I would always try to find something positive to keep me focused.
For almost 10 more years, Daryl Hunt spent time at several prisons in North Carolina, and he endured more denials in federal courts, all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But in the spring of 2003, a judge finally ordered a new round of DNA testing, and Phoebe Zerwick got the assignment to revisit the case.
At first, I was quite disappointed because I didn't have anything brand new to report. All the problems with the case against Daryl Hunt had been written about.
The state crime lab was dragging its feet, and by that fall, it still hadn't retested DNA samples from the crime scene.
What I did have was a different way of telling the story, and laying it out as a story with interesting characters and all those details that you would see in a film or in a work of fiction, except journalism is not fiction, it's true, but all that way of helping a reader into a story changed the way people in Winston-Salem thought about the case at the time, which effectively changed the outcome of the case.
Zerwick's stories revived interest in another case police mishandled.
After he was arrested was when the cover-up began. So after he was arrested, 3 months before his first trial, another woman was raped in downtown Winston-Salem. She was kidnapped from within two blocks of where Deborah Sykes was raped and murdered, and taken to another part of Winston-Salem, to this abandoned drive-in theater. She was raped, she was stabbed multiple times, but she managed to fight back and fight off her attacker. And she identified an attacker. And she also began asking, could this be the same person? Because she recognized that the crime she had suffered was so similar to the crime that Deborah Sykes had been a victim in. And it came out years later that not only did she ask, but that she was told, well, no, it can't be the same man. We've got our guy in prison, and we don't want to mess up the case we've got against him. So early on, there was a suspect that the police did not look at because they didn't want to jeopardize the case they had against Daryl Hunt. And in doing that, not only did they harm Daryl Hunt, obviously, but they also denied justice to another woman. She was told that, oh, they could file charges against this man, but it would just be her word against his, you know, it would all be on her. So she was totally frightened out of pressing charges against the man who turned out to have been the real culprit in the crime that Daryl Hunt served time on.
Well, and I was going to say, and in doing so, denies justice to Deborah Sykes.
Denied justice to Deborah Sykes, and also kept somebody who very possibly hurt other people roaming around Winston-Salem for 20 years.
Zerwick's articles also apparently infuriated the judge who ordered the second round of testing in Hunt's case. He threatened to hold the entire crime lab in contempt. The very next month, a series of tests led right back to the man the second woman had identified in her rape nearly 20 years before. And he confessed. Daryl Hunt was released from prison on Christmas Eve of 2003, 19 years, 3 months, and 10 days after he was wrongfully charged with murdering Deborah Sykes. The foundation that Hunt started after he was exonerated helped formerly incarcerated people find jobs, housing, or maybe just a new set of clothes. Anything that might help them from going back.
People think that you send people to prison and they go to prison and get rehabilitated and come back out. But in reality, they go to prison. Prisons is just a warehouse that's making money off of them and sending them back to the street so they can turn around and go back to prison.
Hunt appeared to be happy using his grace and humility to help not just those who were wrongfully convicted, but anyone who had experienced what he had in prison.
They didn't get me because thank God was protecting me. Because I can look back at it now, and I have since I've been out, at all the times that I was vulnerable. I was so paranoid at one time that I was scared to walk the yard because you had to stay 10 feet away from the fence, but the actual track around the fence was like 5 feet away from the fence. So you're seeing these guards standing up here with these guns, and you, any little thing, they could shoot you and say you trying to escape. So I thank God that he was protecting me.
But as Phoebe Zerwick writes in her book, there were signs of trauma Hunt experienced in prison, even in this interview we've been listening to from 2007 with WUNC's Frank Stacio.
Has it been difficult for you to adjust? How long did it take you to lose? You talked about being paranoid. How difficult was it to make the adjustment?
I'm still adjusting. every day. I mean, I'm sitting here now using a technique that I used in prison.
What is that?
Watching the mirror to see what's behind me. Watching that glass to see that glass that I could see behind me. I mean, that's
wow.
That's how you had to live in prison. I mean, you had to know everything that was around you, and I use it every day. I still use certain things, and I'll probably always be that way.
You know, in the book, you say that you believe that this was something that Daryl Hunt knew, but that it was something that you've come to learn, which is that the story of exoneration as a triumph is a false narrative. Can you explain what you mean?
You know, when he got out, I mean, it was an absolute victory, right? It looked like a victory, and it looked as though he'd finally gotten justice, the system had finally worked, and he would be able to move on with his life. And in some ways, he really did move on with his life. There are reforms in North Carolina that we have because of his advocacy. Chief among them is a state agency called the Innocence Inquiry Commission, which will actually hear claims of innocence. So in North Carolina, unlike in any other state, you can go to this agency, with a claim of innocence, and they will investigate, and if they find evidence, they will hold a hearing on your claim of innocence. So that is a remarkable achievement. So it looked like he was doing well, but it turned out that he wasn't. So he was struggling with the trauma of being in prison, where his life was threatened often by guards and by other inmates. He also was often worried about people basically just trying to betray him and deceive him. In other words, to become snitches against him. And so he would often commit some minor infractions so that he could be sent into solitary confinement for his own protection. And solitary confinement, we know, causes permanent psychiatric problems for people. And he was in solitary, I think I've been able to count up a total of 4 years. Now, it wasn't consecutive, but for months at a time. And one of the stories I tell in the book is Daryl and his attorney, Mark Rabel, went to a speaking engagement in Washington, D.C., and they were sitting in the lobby that had all this kind of groovy decorations of neon lights, and Mark Rabel looks over at Daryl Hunt, and Daryl Hunt is in a cold sweat. He's kind of shaking. He can't breathe. I mean, he's looked like he was maybe having a heart attack or something. And after that pass, Mark said, "You know, what happened there?" And Daryl said, "Well, you see that green light over there, the lime green light? That was the same color as the socks I stared at. There was a reporter wearing lime green socks. And when he was first arrested, they brought him into the warrants office where they had a cell in the warrants office, so basically a cage. And they called all the reporters to come and see the guy who they charged with this horrible murder. And the only way that Daryl, and he was 19 years old, the only way that he could keep from losing it was he stared at these green socks. And so that stayed with him. And 25 years later, he sees some green light of the same color, and he has this all-out panic attack. So I kept up with Daryl Hunt over the years. By 2016, I knew that things were not going all that well for him. He and his wife had divorced, and he had moved to Atlanta, trying to start over again. And he was telling people back home that he had cancer and that it was bad. It was stage four, that he was dying. It was all a little bit vague, but that it was bad. And then I heard that he was coming back to town, and I teach a course at Wake Forest, a first-year writing class, and we use criminal justice as the theme that we write about. And I always invite Mark Rabel to come and talk to the class. And that January, he said, well, Daryl's back in town. He could come too. And I saw Daryl in January of 2016. And, you know, I didn't really know what to say because I knew he'd been ill, but I didn't know, you know, he hadn't talked to me about it. But I said something a little vague, like, oh, I'm glad you're back. You look good. And he said something about, yeah, well, if I'm going to die, I'd rather be here among people I know and people who love me. And at the time, I kind of took it as, well, this is Daryl Hunt being full of grace and stoic, and what a brave man to face this terrible disease in this graceful way. And he came and talked to my class, and he did talk about things that indicated the trauma he was under, but he did it in a very graceful way. He talked about how he always stopped at the ATM machine every day to get so that he would have a receipt, which could then be a record, a kind of alibi if he was ever picked up again. So, you know, there were hints, and there'd been hints over the years that he was struggling, but I don't know that I ever really focused in on that. And I think people closer to him knew that he was struggling, but thought that he had been so resilient as to get through this 20 years in prison that surely he could get through this bad period in his life. And then he disappeared in March and was found dead early one Sunday morning.
In 2016, 12 years after his exoneration, Hunt was found in a locked pickup truck parked at a strip mall in Winston-Salem, dead of an apparent suicide.
It was just so sad and devastating to think that somebody who we all thought was doing okay was not, and to realize the gravity of the harm that had been done to him.
I was wondering what you thought about this, because we as journalists are trained to be purveyors of objectivity, but this is a case that illustrates the unbelievable speed at which that perceived objectivity breaks down, right? When the narrative that has been reported for years is false. So I'm wondering what you've learned as a journalist while writing this book.
One of the things I learned writing this book was that I had never gone back and really reread the way that there's a black weekly in Winston-Salem called the Winston-Salem Chronicle, and the way they covered the case and Daryl Hunt was completely different from the way the Winston-Salem Journal covered it. So the Winston-Salem Journal covered it in the way that, you know, we were always taught in journalism school. You know, you quote the prosecutor, you quote Daryl Hunt's defense. And it was pretty balanced, but it was always right down the middle and always portraying these two points of view as equal. The Winston-Salem Chronicle covered Daryl Hunt from very early on as a young man who claimed his innocence. They published two really in-depth profiles about him while he was awaiting trial. They didn't gloss over. He had a record of misdemeanors at the time. But then they also talked about, you know, his grandfather and his dreams for the future and the kind of life lessons his grandfather taught him. They And then they wrote about things that the journal never reported. They wrote about the plea deal that he turned down, because they published a letter from him about this plea deal that he had turned down. People who read the Chronicle, who would have been black readers mostly, they read a completely different narrative. And that would have shaped the outcome of the trial. It certainly shaped the district attorney's decision in eliminating as many black jurors as he could, because he knew that black people in town were sympathetic towards Darryl.
Phoebe Zerwick is a former reporter with the Winston-Salem Journal. She's now the director of the journalism program at Wake Forest University, and she's written Darryl Hunt's story in much more detail in her new book called Beyond Innocence. It includes a section about the Winston-Salem Police Department's review of the Deborah Sykes case in 2007, which found evidence of fraud, civil rights violations, and obstruction of justice. Hunt settled his case with the city for $1.65 million. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Will Michaels. Thanks for listening.